Well, as we begin the second half of 2025, we here at Musings on Golf take a little peek behind the curtain of the massive golf industry today and bring you inside the ways that many golf facilities operate in the U.S. on a daily basis. Well, on behalf of my co-host, Bob Bupka, who is off this week, I am Kelly Elbin wishing all of you a very happy 249th birthday as we celebrate Independence Day on Friday and look ahead to enjoying a long weekend of, well, family, food, fun, and yeah, a little golf tossed in there along the way. Now, specifically today, we celebrate our special guest, Peter Nanula. Peter's the co-founder and CEO of Concert Golf Partners, which is a boutique owner-operator of almost 40 upscale private golf and country clubs in the United States. You're going to learn a lot about Peter's business, about why companies get involved with primarily private golf clubs throughout the United States. We're also going to hear from Aldrich Potgieter, who just, ladies and gentlemen, might be the next big superstar on the PGA Tour, and I mean that sincerely. And we'll talk a little bit about Padraig Harrington and what has to rank as one of the strangest scenes of the year when he had a dust-up with Roger Maltby after the first round of this U.S. Senior Open, which Padraig went on to win. You know, for some time, I've really wanted to kind of dive into a little bit about the golf course management side, if you will. Now, in the case of Concert Golf Partners, they own and operate. They purchase golf clubs and run them on a day-to-day basis. And there's a lot to handle when it comes to running golf clubs, to owning them. I mean, you're talking about food and beverage and human resources and the maintenance of the golf course itself, marketing, membership sales and retention. There's so many different aspects that go into it. And then you also have companies like Troon Golf and Invited, which was known as Club Corp for many, many years. Bobby Jones Links is another example of golf management companies that to which primarily private clubs pay a fee for those management companies to run the operations at those private clubs throughout the country. Just in terms of numbers, you know, if you look at the National Golf Foundation's figures, there are roughly 16,000 golf courses in the United States. And of the 16,000 courses, there are just a little more than 4,000 private golf clubs in the U.S. And of those 4,000, well, about 2,100 are in fact managed or run by or owned by companies such as Peter Nanula's Concert Golf Partners. I thought it was a really interesting interview. It's different for what we've done in Musings on Golf in the past. And I think that's good. I think it's a kind of a look at inside the industry in a way that we haven't done before and ask questions and learn about, you know, why do you get involved in you know, running golf clubs? How did it all begin? Because for years and years, as Peter will point out, you know, private clubs, when they came along, they had a board of directors, member owned, they ran their own shop. And then, as he points out and accurately, for a lot of them, it reached the point, well, boy, this is a full-time job. We might need some help. We may be good as members of XYZ private club and good in our businesses, but maybe we don't have the expertise of running our golf clubs, our country clubs on a day-to-day basis. So therefore, enter the likes of Concert Golf Partners. And I was impressed with Peter. He's a golf guy. In a lot of ways, grew up playing the game, was the CEO of Arnold Palmer Golf Management for many years. So you know, he watched how Mr. Palmer built trust in his relationships and tried to, you know, forge those trusts and strengthen those relationships through Mr. Palmer's company. And everything I've seen, he's doing an outstanding job with Concert Golf Partners. So on the back end of this interview, you're going to hear, we're going to talk more about long-hitting Aldrich Potgieter and his win at the Rocket Classic. But let's hear right now about Concert Golf Partners and really about the whole way that the golf industry on the private end is shaped by management companies, by owner-operators, in the year 2025, and what does it look like going forward? And we'll hear from Peter right after these messages from our fantastic partners, William and Harry and Titleist. William and Harry has entered a bold new era, led by their new Lionhead logo, a symbol of strength, leadership, and fearless ambition. Step onto the course with purpose, outplay the field, and dominate your opponent, while wearing handcrafted shoes that blend performance, luxury, and unmistakable style. William & Harry offers custom designs featuring your club, company, or organization's logo, so you stand out with every step. Visit williamandharry.com and use code 15OFFMOG for 15% off. William & Harry, walk with the lion.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with your wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Well, if there's one thing I know, it's that we love the great game of golf that we get to play so often. But what we may not know as much about is how the operations of the business side of our clubs and courses allows us to have such a great golf experience. It's interesting. I've wanted to focus on the operations at these places where we play, and I think I found just the right guy to help us navigate through what is a very important part of the business of the game of golf. Peter Nanula is the co-founder and CEO of Concert Golf Partners, a boutique owner-operator of upscale private golf and country clubs nationwide. Peter, I'm really excited about this opportunity to speak with you, and welcome to Musings on Golf.
Same here. Yeah, thanks for having me, Kelly. This is great.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, we've focused our podcast on having, you know, great storytelling from golfers and administrators of the game on all levels, you know, through the years. But Peter, look, this is so important on a day-to-day basis of how golf clubs are run and the financial picture that goes into it. So in talking with you, I kind of want to take a 40,000 foot approach to the management, the operations of clubs. Let's begin with Concert Golf Partners. Tell our audience who Concert Golf Partners is and what you produce for the more than 35 clubs that you're involved with nationwide.
Yeah. Thanks for asking, Kelly. Concert Golf Partners, as you said, we are an owner and operator of now 39 private golf and country clubs. We don't manage golf courses or clubs for other people to make fees. There are companies who do that. They call them management companies. You've probably heard of Troon Golf, Kemper Sports. They manage, or if you and I owned a golf course, we could hire them and say, hey, we're not in town that often. We need somebody else to help us operate it. And we would pay them some essentially consulting fees to run it for us.
Right.
We don't do that at all. We're one of the owner operators. So we invest our own capital to acquire a club, and then we operate it with our own people, and we own and operate 39 private clubs.
Right. So I belong to a private club here in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, and we are right now run by board and essentially self-run. But to your point, we had a management company for many years that ran our business. So it is two very different models, Peter.
Right? Very different. Very, yeah. Two totally different businesses inside of golf, right? So you could hire a third-party management company, pay them some fees, and they would help you with staffing. Maybe your general manager or your food and beverage director quit, or you need a new superintendent. They could help you get a new person. They could produce reports for you every month and say your membership's up or down, or we lost a little money, we made a little money. But they're basically like a consulting firm for people who happen to own a golf course or a country club. We don't do that. We are in the owner-operator business, meaning we buy clubs, we fix them up, and we own and operate them ourselves with our own staff that's now over 5,000 employees.
Okay, so why did you take that different approach? What did you see in putting together the company and looking at that business model differently and how you could affect positively the operations at the private clubs that you're with? But that, not
Yeah, I
that you're
mean,
with, excuse me, that you own, that you own.
Well, when it's your own club, right, and you're investing your own capital, you care a lot. Think about a rental car. If you rent a Hertz rental car at the airport there, how do you treat it? You give it back when you're done with it, right? You might treat it reasonably well, but it's not yours, right? And so we think of ourselves as not being in the business like those other companies of just trying to make a fee for producing some reports and some help to our clients. Our clients are our members. We have almost 30,000 members of our clubs. If those members are having a great experience today, the golf course was in great condition, the food was great, the service was fantastic, people remembered my name and my wife's name when I walked in. We've done our job, right? Like 30,000 members every day want a great member experience at their private club. We're in that business. And if we treat them well, we'll make some money, just like your favorite hotel or restaurant. If the food's good, the service is good, and they take good care of you, then you'll think well of them, you'll go back, you'll tell your friends.
Much like that favorite hotel or restaurant that you might go to, with a golf operation, I mean, you have so many components to it, Peter, from human resources to golf course maintenance, the food and beverage. And so, again, for my listeners here, for our listeners, I want you to maybe give them an idea of the fact that there are so many areas that you touch on that are vital to the success of a club on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's really true. Like when we all go out to a restaurant to eat, they do one thing. They provide us with food and beverages, right? And that's it. Whereas a club, to your point, does a lot of things under one roof, where we've got the golf course, we've usually got tennis courts, pickleball, racket sports. We usually have swimming pools. We have a pro shop with merchandise in there. We have a number of different businesses all under one roof. And in a private club setting, you got members. They're paying dues. They signed a contract to pay dues, be a member there, and they want all of these things to be well run for them.
Now, do you have at your clubs, do you have board of directors or do you have staff on site? How does that model work?
Yeah, so we have staff on site, right? So like the most recent club that we just acquired that we'll talk about here in a minute up on Cape Cod, they had 400 or 500 employees at the club. We just acquired it a couple of weeks ago. That whole staff stays in place. They all stay there. We need them. They have a general manager, they have a chef, they have a superintendent who maintains the golf courses, they have a tennis director, they have a huge staff of people. We don't have anybody on Cape Cod. They're our staff now. They report to us. Now, who do they report to? They used to
Right.
report to a real estate developer who was selling homes or lots to people. At maybe some of the clubs that you've been a member of, Kelly, maybe it's a member-owned club, an equity club. And you may have a rotating board of 8 or 10 volunteer members of the club who say, sure, I'll sit on the board this year. I'm a banker, lawyer, doctor. I don't know anything about running a country club, but I'll raise my hand and spend a lot of time helping my club be successful. If you're used to reporting to those folks, you're not getting a lot of expertise if you're a general manager or a department head at a club. But if you are part of our network of clubs, you've got agronomists, dining and culinary people, you've got tennis experts, golf experts. You're reporting into a bunch of people who have 38 other clubs we do this at, and we've learned all the lessons, good, bad, and ugly, and we've gotten pretty good at it over the years.
Well, and that expertise is critical, right? And that knowledge of how each of those components of a golf operation works is vital to the success.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right? I grew up in golf. My father's was a golf professional at a men's club in the DC area. I was very
Okay.
fortunate, played at Bethesda Country Club outside of great club. always, been a member-driven, board of director-led club
Yes.
over the years. But things change over time. So from a 40,000 foot view, if you will, give us a sense of when did the industry, if you will, start to transition a bit to get more of management companies involved. Club Corp, for example, was a massive player back in the day and continued to be through what are they known, I think, as Invite today.
Invited. Yeah,
Invited,
exactly.
yeah. But maybe a little history there in terms of why that third party, if you will, got involved at certain clubs.
Yeah, so go back to the 60s and 70s. We're dating ourselves here, you and I. Club Corp started with private clubs, and American Golf, if you remember that name, started
Sure.
with municipal golf courses. And
Right.
they said, boy, there's a lot of these clubs out there that are not professionally operated. Their funding is up and down. The people who run them aren't experts. Maybe we can bring some expertise and some capital and run these, like a hotel company. Think about like a Marriott. Like, what were hotels like before Marriott, Ritz-Carlton, Four Seasons, and people started to develop a good model? Well, now we got professional companies doing this. Today, you have, like we talked about, Troon Golf, you have Kemper. They are the leading companies that manage golf courses for other people, and they do a pretty good job, right? There's a lot of things an absentee owner might need. They do that for their clients. And then there are people like us and Arcus in Dallas, Arcus Golf,
Heard of them,
Heritage
sure.
Golf. There are groups like us, Club Corp also, who own and operate their own clubs, and just like a hotel company, tries to provide better hospitality, capital, purchasing power, right? We can buy fertilizer and chemicals for the golf course, or food and beverage and that sort of thing for the clubhouse. We're buying that stuff for 39 clubs. So compared to a standalone club like you have been a member at, we probably save several hundred thousand dollars a year just because we got a group purchasing discount. We can then use
Sure.
that cash to plow back in. Maybe we'll build pickleball courts this year. Maybe we'll put in a spa next year, right? It helps run the course better if you've got some of those savings.
And with those savings, as you said, to put the investment into it, you've got to always be looking long term, right? This
Yes.
isn't just a this isn't just a hey, let's build something for this season, or let's put these shrubs in for whatever. This is always has to be a long term play, right?
Precisely. And you asked a good point. So if your dad grew up in the business and you've been at member-owned clubs, one of the things a lot of people don't realize is if you're just talking about private clubs for now, there's about 4,000 of them in the US, which is a lot. About 80% of those are member-owned equity clubs. So you, me, eight other people volunteer to sit on the board for a couple of years and volunteer our time, go to committee meetings and board meetings. None of us have any expertise, but we're like local volunteers on our school board or our church board, which is nice to see. People are passionate about their club. They don't have any particular expertise. Most clubs are equity clubs, but the companies like ours that are hospitality businesses that focus on country clubs, like we're experts at doing that. And so we will have an advisory board of members that we meet with. We ask them what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. Hey, after we finish the pickleball courts, what do you want us to do next? And they are our sounding board. But we don't need them for capital. We don't assess our members like an equity club does. We don't send them a bill every time we want to redo our irrigation system or put in, a new member grill. We don't need them for their golf expertise because they haven't been doing this for 30 some years, like me and my team. But we do need them for feedback, right? How'd you like that member guest tournament this year? What do you think about the condition the golf course is in? What'd you think about the food? We're starting to serve it out by the pool now. Give us some feedback so we can keep getting better and give you a good member experience.
Yeah, and you've got to have that member connection, right? You have to keep that going, and it's like any level of communications, right?
Exactly. So you asked the point like the history. So it started with Club Corp and American Golf. Now you've got some companies like ours doing it. I think in the old days, Kelly, there was some resistance to sort of corporations, businesses getting involved in golf. You heard about a negative things about management companies. Maybe there was some fear that people would lose passion for the game, or the soul of the club would be destroyed or something. And it could be true that like some of that went on in the early days. Now everywhere I go, it seems pretty clear to most people that the better companies, like when we do it, when we're at the top of our game, we can bring capital, we can bring expertise, we've got buying power, we have streamlined decision making. We don't need to spend a year and a half talking about our new clubhouse. We just hire an architect and start building it. We don't need to have 20 meetings with 500 members arguing about whether we should put in pickleball or we should redo our greens. We got people who like pickleball. We got people who like golf. Why don't we do both? And we just do it. Like if you go to a Four Seasons wherever you live, you don't have a bunch of meetings with them. They know what their customers want, and they put in a new spa, and they make things nicer in the rooms because they know what most of their clients want. That's our job, is we've got 500 families to make happy at the club. We got member surveys. We're talking to you all the time. We have that advisory board. Tell us what you want to see, and we'll try to deliver that for you.
Well, and expertise and efficiency, right? You can get a lot done.
Exactly. But importantly, it's not a cookie cutter thing. This isn't corporate golf. I think a lot of people wonder, oh, you're going to become part of some company. We used to just be XYZ Country Club, and now we're part of some. Well, we are really proud of our record of maintaining the traditions, like your member guest or your charity golf tournament or all that unique stuff that makes a club unique. We want to keep it that way, the culture of that club. We don't try to change any of that. We just in the back where nobody sees it, if we could buy everything for $400,000 a year less, and we could bring some of our corporate team from Orlando to help with the menu or help with the golf course condition, we can help the staff of your club do a better job for you. And we have lots of capital to invest, so we don't need to do a member assessment. It just works better for everyone.
So pleased to be joined by Peter Nanula, the co-founder and CEO of Concert Golf Partners. So before I ask you the next question, back to what you were saying about having, few people who have to make decisions and how much you can get done. So Peter, I oversaw the production and execution of a 30th anniversary book that turned out beautifully for a club in Naples, Florida. And the entirety of the structure there is the owner, excuse me, the president of the club, the PGA director of golf, and the superintendent. That's it. And Peter Nanula, you can get a heck of a lot done when that's your group running
Bingo.
things on a day-to-day basis, right? Now, the Florida Golf Club that I did the book for is a bit of an anomaly that way. But to your point, anytime you have that you have the pulse of your membership and you have that expertise and you know them, man, you can accomplish great things for whatever type of club you're looking to establish and move forward with.
Less meetings, less committees, less bureaucracy. Exactly. The way you described it is the way we try to run clubs, where we're face to face with our members and they're telling us what they like and don't like. Let's respond today.
All right. So in 2011, you and Susan Donovan, who is your chief operating officer, founded Concert Golf Partners. Before that, though, you had an affiliation from 1993 to 2000 with the King, the great Mr. Arnold Palmer,
Okay.
as the CEO of Arnold Palmer Golf Management. I was fortunate to know Mr. Palmer throughout the years, but you worked with him. How did you land that position? And what was it like to work with Mr. Palmer?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Great story. I cold called Mr. Palmer, just picked up the phone and called him, and one of his people introduced me to him, and he invited me to Muirfield Village. He invited me to Jack's tournament, the Memorial. They were honoring Arnie in 1993 at the Memorial tournament. And Arnie's wife, Winnie Palmer, who was also an amazing person, she made us a super high cholesterol breakfast in their little condo. And we shook hands. Arnie said, "We don't need lawyers. Your word is your bond." He was that kind of guy, just reached across the table. And then I got involved and ran the business for him. And another funny story, I remember during those years, I ran into Arnie at Augusta National. I was playing with a small group. He was there playing with like the Treasury Secretary and some other big luminaries. He was up on the first tee about to tee off, and I was coming up number nine. I'm sure you know Augusta really well. Of course,
Yep.
I see him there, and he yells out across the fairway, "Hey, Peter, what are you doing there?" Of course, I chili dipped my approach shot, made like double or triple bogey or some other
Right,
embarrassing
right.
thing. But we just, it was an incredible honor to try to steward a company for him, because everywhere I went, people said, "We just trust Arnie. If we leave our club in
Yes.
your hands, we know that Arnie is going to take good care of our golf course or country club." And we just had a ball trying to live up to that standard.
Was the Mott there at Arnold Palmer Golf Management different from Concert Golf Partners, number one? And then number two, what did you learn from those 7 years as CEO working with Mr. Palmer that you were able to then use and use to today at Concert Golf?
Yeah, great question. I can see why you're good at this podcasting thing. Largely the same. We owned and operated about 30 country clubs and golf courses, but we also did public golf courses. We did private country clubs and public golf courses back then in the Palmer days. We did both. Concert Golf, when we formed that in 2011, Susan and I, we've decided to focus strictly on private country clubs because we liked it. We had just come out of a deep recession. If you remember, 2008, 9 was a rough period for the economy. And the fact that members aren't making a decision every day whether they want to go play golf and spend 50 or 100 bucks, they've made a 10-year decision with their families to join a country club and they have a longer term relationship. We just thought private clubs were an opportunity that made more sense for our next company. But what did we learn? I would say that thing that we were just talking about, when you have a company of any kind, your company, ours, your name, your reputation is everything. And so trying to live up to the Arnold Palmer standard is very challenging, but it teaches you lessons about anything you write, anything you say, the way you treat somebody, the way you look somebody in the eye. It all matters, and it develops a reputation. And how did the king get the reputation he had? He was making a ton of money, had a lot of success. He never turned a single kid on the ropes down to sign a golf ball, sign an autograph, look them in the eye, and make you feel like you're the only person standing there. Like, that is a unique thing. If we
Yes.
could all learn something from Arnold, that would be the biggest one I would take away.
Yeah, I agree. That's the word to describe him, he was special just in so many ways. Okay, so I know you're an attorney. I know you have some degrees from Harvard, but tell me more about you in terms of golf. When did you get involved in the game from a playing standpoint, and then enjoying it? And how often do you play now?
No, I played in high school. I was on the varsity golf team in college, so that was really fun. They took me out freshman year and they said, "We play at this little club over in the suburbs." It was called the Country Club in Brookline, Mass. Little did I know. That was really fun. And then when I was a young investor at a big investment firm, some of the executives from Club Corp and American Golf came into our offices looking for capital to leave those companies and build their own businesses, and they assigned it to me. So I was a guy who had played some college golf, probably not at your level or your dad's level, but I was a decent golfer back then. And then I got in the investment world. I was a young lawyer and an investor guy, and people started showing us golf deals. Anyway, I just thought, what a great industry to get involved in. I think, maybe I could have some success in it. So I left working for a big investment firm and started the Arnold Palmer business with Arnie. So that was really fun. Lately, don't play as much. I played all over, like you probably have, but I got a herniated disc in my back, and so I'm not able to. So I think I probably over torqued it a few times there, Kelly. And hopefully people ease off when they get to be 60 years old. They listen to their bodies. I never did.
Yes. Yeah, you just kept going, right?
Just keep swinging, and now I've got a son who's 25 years old, hits
There
it
you go.
50 yards past me, and I can't stand it.
Yeah, I can relate to that with a son who's 25 as well. I very,
Oh, do
very much
you?
so. Yeah, very much. All right, so let's talk a little. Let's kind of drill down for a second. So you mentioned newest club you're involved in, the club at New Seabury on Cape Cod. How did that process work? Why did you go after that club, number one? Now, I know before you answered, Francis Ouimet, who won the U.S. Open back in the day and really changed American golf in so many ways, referred to that club, to New Seabury, as the Pebble Beach of the East. So he saw a lot in it. How does Concert Golf Partners get involved with a club like that? And then once you are involved in it, how does the process work in terms of, if you will, maybe correcting it, helping it, et cetera?
Yeah, great opportunity. It we'd always known about New Seabury, but never knew if it might come available. The owners of it were real estate developers. They were selling their last lots and homes. And a lot of times real estate developers like that, the club is just an amenity to help them sell homes. So once they're done, they're thinking, what are we doing with this country club? So they hired a broker. That broker went out, called all the leading players like us who have some capital and could take something like this on. We got involved early on, and we're the most aggressive of anyone. We had already owned a club you might be aware of called Blue Hill Country Club outside of Boston.
Absolutely.
Great club. And
hosted,
so we already liked
the PGA Championship, I think.
Back in the 50s, and it's been a very successful club. And we always wanted to do more in Massachusetts anyway. So this one came up, and we went at it pretty hard. And luckily, we convinced the owners that we would be good stewards. We met with members, we met with homeowners association people, we met with the owners and convinced them we would be a good long-term steward for the club. So you bid on it. Yeah, you bring your team to bear and try to make some improvements. And now we think we can elevate the club. It's doing really well. This is a very healthy club that's almost full to a wait list. And they have a beach club. They have all manner of amenities, 36 holes, including an ocean course. It's the one that Francis Ouimet described the Pebble Beach of the East. So it has a lot going for it. But we think, like, the fitness area, it's pretty small for a membership like this. We think that could be expanded. They have a little beach club. We think we can do more beach amenities because I think a lot of people in Boston or on the Cape, summer is huge for them, right? And they want to take advantage of the beach. And so we think we can expand that. They have a driving range, but we think the practice facilities could be upgraded. And then, you know, as we always do, let's go talk to the members themselves. Let's ask the members. You love your club, but what would you like to see? We have capital. We would like to upgrade things. What's most important to you?
We're in our finishing touches on a terrific interview with Peter Nanula, who is the co-founder and CEO of Concert Golf Partners. So, right, that going back to New Seabury for a second, right? That has to be, do you put plans in place to say, okay, this is what we want to deliver within X number of years. This is what our vision is for the next 10 years. How does that process work in working conjunction with the membership?
Exactly. We come, we'll have a open house and a few sort of wine and cheese parties. We'll get to know the members. We'll announce some of our vision for some of the things I just described that we think we'd like to do. And then we'll basically sit down and start listening to the members, do some focus groups, some smaller settings where people are more comfortable sharing. And we've already been approached by a number of the members. There's some hitters at the club. There's some very avid golfers. Yeah. There's some very successful, very affluent people who live down there on the Cape right in this community. And of course, they've had opinions about what they would like to see, and they've been telling the prior owners. Now they're telling us. So in conjunction with them, we'll work on, you know, this year, next year kind of priorities. And then there'll be some things that are further out that we can't do just yet, or they require permits, right? It takes time with the town to get approval to do certain things. And like beach type things would be a good example where the town likes to protect the shoreline and the beach, and you can't just immediately make a bunch of dramatic changes without getting some approvals. But we'll work on those things and then continually listening to our members to see where we can go next.
Let's talk on a broader scale. Obviously, COVID was nothing more. It was a huge boon for the golf industry. It just was. So many more people played the game. And continue to play the game today. Peter, I'm wondering from your perspective, okay, what do you see? What's the health of the golf industry at large today? And do you have any kind of a feel or sense for it of what it's going to be like, what it could be, should be like in the next, say, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, you nailed it. COVID boomed golf, right? Amongst a few other industries, but golf is at all time highs. If your club or your golf course isn't doing well now, you got to wonder what you're waiting for, right? Because we got all these people that got up out of their office buildings and found the club as their kind of third place. We have off course golf, which you've probably done entire podcasts about, Top Golf and these other golf simulator models. That has fed a whole bunch of new people into the game. Like my son and his friends spend as much time at simulators,
yep,
doing fun golf things, you know, often involving some booze and some social stuff that country clubs weren't set up exactly like that, and golf courses, right? So you got off course feeding a bunch of people into the game. They're learning and they're thinking, all right, where can we do more of this? And sometimes they go to a golf course. Sometimes they actually join a country club. And so that's been a nice turbocharger for the club industry. So golf is in a great place right now. Now the question, if you're on the board of a member-owned club, if you own a club, the question is, where does it go next? And do you take advantage of all these new players? Are you going to borrow a ton of money and spend a gazillion dollars on a bunch of improvements? And then when the next recession hits, are you going to regret that? Or are you going to try to cater to this new audience and be a little bit more responsive? And if people want pickleball or padel up in New England, or put in a spa or provide new services, how are you going to respond? Because now is boom times for golf.
Yeah. How about from standpoint of Concert Golf Partners? What is your vision? What are you seeing? What are your goals, if you will, for the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, we're not trying to be the biggest. We're just trying to be the highest quality in everything we do. So very selective about the clubs that we bring into our portfolio. New Seabury, good example. A very top-notch golf course with all the amenities and a beach, which is rare for us. Invest back into these great clubs to make them even better. Innovate. Like, we have a new reciprocal program called Symphony, where if you're a member of New Seabury, Kelly, you can play 38 other clubs of ours. Plus, beautiful, you get access to TPC clubs and other benefits. Well, that's pretty cool. Members love that. So we're just trying to give the owners of the better clubs out there the right long-term home for their club. Their staff, owners of clubs care about their staff because they love their staff, their members. And what if they don't want to take the club on for the next 20 or 40 years, who would be the right home for that? Like with Arnie, like back in my time with Arnie, people were always wondering, who could we entrust our club to? And we're trying to build a boutique, but a home for the top clubs for the longer term.
Right. So for you having 39 clubs, you like that. You, as you said, you're a boutique. You're going to be very selective, right? The numbers, it's more quality, if you will, to use that term. It's definitely for you, quality over quantity, correct?
You nailed it. Exactly. Just a few every year, but really top-notch clubs that you, if you're a member of ours, you're excited when you see that announcement. Hey, they just added New Seabury up on Cape Cod. Oh my gosh, my family goes up there every summer. Now we can play up there instead of, you know, some lesser club that you're not super excited about playing or utilizing.
Right. We'll close this with a question that I've had the good fortune of asking at the end of all of our interviews. And it's one, Peter, that really has kind of elicited a lot of various responses. Some you would expect, some actually emotional. And that would be, if you could play golf with three other individuals, sort of a dream round, if you will, whether those individuals are still with us or they're deceased, who would round out that group for you? And would there be one club, maybe it's among the 39, would there be one club that you would say, oh, for goodness sakes, we got to play here. This is where I want to take my dream foursome to play.
I love it. That's a fun one. All right. So let's tee it up at New Seabury at the Ocean Course.
Nice.
June is a good time to do that. Let's get Arnold out there.
Yeah.
Although, man, I never could shoot a decent round when he was watching me. Let's get Arnold. Let's get Tiger, right?
Yeah.
And let's get Annika Sorenstam, who I met on an airplane once.
Nice.
And lets the four of us go out and play the ocean course at New Seabury. That would be pretty memorable.
That's pretty darn good. That's pretty darn good. Go back to something you said earlier. I think it's true. So much of that key is how do you balance, Peter, that sort of that traditional view of the game, right? With what we know now, with the simulators and bringing that, making the whatever the golf experience may be, right? Catering to those different groups that look at the game in different ways. And it's so imperative, it seems to me, to the long-term health of the golf, to golf.
You
It's
can
almost
do both.
everything.
You
Yeah,
can
you
do
can,
both.
right?
Too many people in our industry, Kelly, think it's one or the other, and it's the end of traditional golf, or it's this new, it needs to modernize. You could do both. We have super low digit, super serious golfers at virtually all of our clubs, and they want the traditional golf experience. They got their group. 16 guys have been going out at 8:30 in the morning on Saturday for the last 20 years. Okay, let's make that great and let's make the tournaments really well run. That's what those guys want. But we can also have a simulator in there and year round on the Cape. Yeah, weather gets pretty crummy in the winter. Let's have the simulator in there. Who's using it? Well, some guys are low handicappers are working on their game. People are in there drinking and having a good time and they're betting each other and having a ball. That's a different group of people. Those people might be high handicappers. They might be beginners. We can serve both audiences. It's not like everybody you go to at a restaurant orders the same food. It's not like every hotel you go to, everybody looks like you and me, right?
Exactly. And if you're right, if you're giving your members one more reason to stay at that club and spend money at that club, right? It just makes
Bingo.
it makes the it makes your membership, your involvement that much greater.
Bingo. And you make friendships for life in golf.
Yeah.
Like, could be people you play golf with, could be people you hang out at the club with. Keep making it interesting. And if some groups want to stick to that same group for 30 years straight and just play golf the same foursome they always, that's okay. But that doesn't mean the whole club should stay like that. We should also attract women into the game. We should attract juniors into the game. We should get simulators. And if people want to do wine and nine, let them go do that on a Tuesday afternoon. Is that really destroying your club, sir? No, because you and your hardcore game of low handicappers are still going out at Saturday morning at 8:30. That's great. I'm glad there's a place for the wine and nine people to go. They're not so serious. They don't care about all the rules. They just want to have a good time and a cocktail. We can do both.
Peter, for those who want to learn more about Concert Golf Partners, where do they go? What do they do?
Go to our website. Yep, concertgolfpartners.com. You'll see about our new clubs like New Seabury. You'll learn a little bit more about our company. We'd love to talk to you about your club.
Peter Nanula, co-founder and CEO of Concert Golf Partners. Man, this has been a lot of fun. I'm so pleased that we were able to do this. Thanks for taking the time to do this and be anxious to see what that 40th club is going to be. For too long, huh?
We'll send you an invite. Yeah, thanks for doing this. I love your show. This is great.
William and Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William and Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William and Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. I hope you learned a lot from that interview with Peter Nanula. As I said going in, sharp guy. It's a big business. Golf's a big business, and a lot's at stake at private clubs. It is. Yes, it's about the golf experience and enjoying your time there. But it's first and foremost it's a gathering where you want to make sure that the club sustains itself, grows, and stays with the times. And I thought Peter was excellent. And watching Aldrich Pottgeter win in a five-hole playoff on Sunday at the Rocket Classic, I learned a lot about the modern game, maybe even more so than I knew going in. And by that, and when you're watching guys just typically drive the ball 347 yards, 343 yards, I mean, it became a mash-a-thon, over that five-hole playoff, primarily with him and Max Greisserman. And both had chances to win for the first time on the PGA Tour. Chris Kirk bowed out after missing a short putt for par on the second playoff hole. But I was impressed with both Aldrich and with Max, and particularly with Potgieter. I mean, his story is fascinating. Number one is he's the youngest player on the PGA Tour, period, at 20. His father travels with him in large part because, hey, when it comes to renting a car or doing some of the things we might take for granted, well, the kid's only 20 years old. He is the youngest South African to ever win on the PGA Tour. And that's very heady company. When you start talking about Gary Player and Ernie Els and Louis Oosthuizen and Charles Schwartzel, I mean, you're talking about some big time names. It was interesting. Schwartzel, a couple of years ago, when he was paired with Potgieter in the Masters, he was he said, this kid hits the ball so far, it's scary. And the kid at that time was 18 years old. And Schwartzel wasn't exaggerating. In fact, on top of all this, Potgieter's the longest hitter on the PGA Tour. He averages just under 327 yards per drive. And Max Greisserman is right there with him. And that's what I found fascinating with the playoff between those two. I mean, you've got driver nine iron from 195, nine iron from 200 yards. And the distances that these guys hit the ball is just off the charts crazy. And Max, I think, will get there. He's been close. He's an all-around solid player. Kind of reminds me of Denny McCarthy, with whom both of them went to Duke. Both of them rock solid players all around, but they haven't broken through on the PGA Tour. Potgieter to get that first win to 20, and frankly, he could have won earlier this year. It was only because for Brian Campbell, when Potgieter lost to Campbell in a playoff in Mexico, and for if not for almost virtually an act of God, where Campbell's drive in on the, one of the playoff holes, the final one, looking like it was for all intent and purposes going to go into the trees, out of bounds, kicked out, and Campbell went on to make birdie and win the event in Mexico. Otherwise, Potgieter likely would have two wins this year. But very impressed with the kid. Great story, big, great background on his parents moving to Australia when he was younger to support this kid on all fronts. And at age 20, you talk about the golf world sort of wide open ahead of him. Let's hear from Aldrich Potgieter to break through at such a young age at 20 and win the Rocket Classic at Detroit Golf Club.
It was a big grind. I mean, it was a very long day and kind of couldn't get ahead of myself. And I didn't get off to the best start. So I knew there was a lot of holes still available, still to get back. And there was a switch that kind of went off when I was actually, when I lost the lead. And I kind of felt like, okay, I can kind of chase something. So I kind of had to pull myself out of the environment I was in before those first couple of holes and get in that chase mode where I can kind of play some different golf that I played the first 3 days. So when that went off, I birdied the par five on seven, birdied eight, had a really good look on nine. So I felt the momentum switch there, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're going to hear it's an unusual sounding name, but once you say Potgieter, you hear it enough, you know how to pronounce it. I think you're going to be hearing that name a lot. And another name that you've heard through the years, and I have great respect for Padraig Harrington, and I'm happy that he won his second U.S. Senior Open at the beautiful Broadmoor in Colorado. What a spectacular venue that is. I believe the U.S. Senior Open is going to go back to the Broadmoor a couple more times over the next 10 years. All that said, I thought Padraig Harrington was out of bounds, if you will, with a dust-up, a strange situation he had with Roger Maltby. That I would imagine you've seen coming out of Padraig's first round when he hit a drive that went into a large bush and a number of caddies and marshals and so forth were looking for the ball. And Roger Maltby has been walking with players on the PGA Tour and Champions Tour for, geez, 40 years was, I guess he said later, he had the producer in his ear saying, "Hey, I need you on camera to tell what's going on, give us an update." And Padraig Harrington chirping at him saying, "Why aren't you helping us look for the ball?" And then later, Maltby tried to explain himself after the round was over, and Padraig was talking about, "Hey, you've been out here all these years; you should know better." On it was very strange. I thought Padraig was flat out wrong. I mean, it's not even really the responsibility of Roger Maltby to be looking for Padraig Harrington's golf ball. And I would hope that maybe quietly he apologized to him later. I don't know that he did. I just found it to be strange. I'm happy that Padraig won, but I thought it was a little bit disrespectful, very honestly, for a guy who has really given a lot and has been a terrific on-course reporter on the for NBC Sports and Golf Channel for many, many years. Well, wishing all of you again a very happy Independence Day, 4th of July, down here in Florida. Looking forward to playing a little scramble at my club, and I imagine a lot of you will be playing in golf events over the weekend. Enjoy, hit them straight. Bob Bupka, look forward to hearing and getting you back here soon. Kelly Elbin signing off, wishing all of you happy 249th birthday for a great Independence Day weekend. We'll see you next week on Musings on Golf.